the experience that we're all feeling of, are we or are we not subject to, or have we been in contact with someone who might have corona that eventually might result in our developing an infection, is kind of very much the same as a cancer patient who has gone for investigation of some kind of lesion, which is as yet unknown, and to be further diagnosed and brought to some sort of resolution.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Norman Straker. Dr. Straker is an analyst on the faculty of the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Weill Cornell College of Medicine, and he is a distinguished life fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. Dr. Straker is one of the original faculty members of the first psycho-oncology program at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, and he pioneered the development of that subspecialty. Within that field, he's created two films that illustrate the psychological issues facing doctors, patients, and family members who confront cancer. He chairs a discussion group at the American Psychoanalytic Association entitled Psychoanalysis and Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy of Patients with Cancer. He edited a book, Facing Cancer and the Fear of Death, A Psychoanalytic Perspective on Treatment. And he has two articles in press on the Journal of Psychodynamic Psychiatry, one on the treatment of cancer patients who survived and the other on the treatment of patients who died. Today's conversation is partially about his work in psycho-oncology, but it's also very currently involved in the crisis that we're all involved with, the COVID-19 pandemic. This is being recorded on Friday, March 13th, and we have all gone through our first week of crisis planning, if not calamity planning, and we are all struggling in our own ways. We therapists, we patients, we everybody are living with a cloud that's unique in our lifetimes. And Dr. Straker will share with us some of the similarities that we are all facing with those patients who are nervously waiting some certainty or uncertainty about their cancer diagnosis. He feels that there's an overlap between the two, and he brings his expertise in psycho-oncology to all of us today who are living in fear of the virus. I hope you find this conversation useful in our own struggles. Norm, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks, Norm.
Norm, you and I have been talking for some time about us having a podcast conversation focusing on your really groundbreaking work in the field of psycho-oncology. That's the field where one brings a dynamic and analytic ear to working with patients who are struggling with cancer. Given the current crisis that we are all operating under, I thought it'd be best if we postpone that for another time. And yet, when you and I were speaking about that, you shared with me an observation you've made, which is what we're here to talk about today, which is that you noticed a similarity between those patients who are expecting and worried about getting a diagnosis of cancer, to share many similarities with the many people, many of us, who are worried about getting a diagnosis that they carry COVID-19, the virus. Can you share with us what similarity you've observed and how it has helped you inform how you deal with both cancer patients and either potential or actual patients struggling with the virus?
I'll be happy to do that, Harvey. This, in fact, reminds me of the crisis of 9/11, when I was asked to talk to the staff at Cornell and at Grand Rounds using the metaphor of cancer to describe the kind of panic we were all going through right after 9/11. So in a similar way, I think that the experience that we're all feeling of are we or are we not subject to, or have we been in contact with someone who might have corona that eventually might result in our developing an infection, is kind of very much the same as a cancer patient who has gone for investigation of some kind of lesion, which is as yet unknown, and to be further diagnosed and brought to some sort of resolution with a diagnosis and a treatment. Unfortunately, for us in this corona situation, we have much less information. We are not going to get good information for some time, and we don't have some of the benefits that occur with a situation in which we have a caring doctor who can tell us, you know, what to expect, what the treatments are going to be, and hopefully that we can come out on the other end. So what we're dealing with is, in some respects, a much more serious set of uncertain circumstances than even with cancer. So how does one approach this with one's patients? I go back to my experience with cancer patients and some of the core concepts I have about what you could expect from your individual patients. How individual patients will respond to this will depend, of course, you know, on their personality and character structure, on their defenses, on their prior history of dealing with crises. That is, how resilient have they been, and their level of object relations.
I would add another difference that it has been said, and I'd be interested in your reaction to it, that physicians who themselves have had cancer approach patients with cancer differently, with an attunement that those who haven't had the disease may not be able to achieve. We are all in this together, physician and patient. We are all at risk, and we are all struggling with uncertainty. And that must add a different element to how you work with patients.
Very much to the point. On the listservs today, both Cornell and the New York Psychoanalytic, the therapists were all talking about how exhausted they were, how difficult it was to deal with the anxiety of the patients when they themselves were anxious. And so there is this unfortunate, lack of calm on the part of the therapist in dealing with the patients, which makes one very exhausted. The experience I have with doctors who are therapists, particularly who have cancer, who treat patients, is that in the early periods after their cancer, I advise them not to treat patients because they have too much anxiety, they have too much identification. After several years, I think they're more attuned and they're more helpful. But in the early stages, it's not unlike where we are right now, which is how difficult it is to work with people who are under the same threat.
And can you share us some experiences either with particular patients who are in acute danger of having the virus identified in them or actually have the virus identified, and with cancer patients as well?
Sure. So I talked to one of my patients just 2 or 3 days ago who was about I'd say about the seventh or eighth day after having what seemed to be corona, although at the time that he first got sick, he couldn't get a test, which made him quite anxious. But at the same time, he did go into quarantine, and he was, you know, coughing and having some shortness of breath when we were talking. This person is a very active businessman, a very macho type. And in speaking to him about his situation, he was actually trying to minimize his concerns and trying to make it sound like it was all going to be fine. And said to him, you know, I know you to be an extremely active person. You have ADD. You're a deal maker. You're always traveling around the world making deals. I said, I just wonder about the challenge you have of being alone. It's a great interest of mine. Is how are you managing to be alone and not to be running around? And he said, you know, quite interestingly, he says, I find it's fine. So I said, well, what do you think about it? And he said, well, I've been thinking a lot about my life, which I never get a chance to do. I've been doing a lot of reflecting on how fortunate I've been, what kind of wonderful family I have. And I never have a chance to do that sort of thing. And I said, And have you had any concerns about your mortality? And he said, well, you know, yeah, I guess I have. It's somewhat embarrassingly, as if it was, you know, a sign of weakness to admit. And I said, well, what about that? He said, well, he said, I would be okay with dying. He said, I've looked back on my life, even though I'm 45, I've done a lot of things. I would like to do more, you know, I would be okay with that. So I said, well, if you have more time, have you given some thought to what you might want to do in the future? He said, well, you know, now that I've made so much money, he said, I've thought perhaps that I might do some public service. So this break and this confrontation with mortality changed this man to think more about giving back, which I think is not uncommon for people who face death.
You know, you bring up how he spends his time alone. One of the points you make in your writing on oncology patients is the importance of tolerating uncertainty.
Right.
Now, we are all, the whole world is now sitting and tolerating uncertainty. And we do it as best as we do it. But can you tell us something about what you've learned from how central that is in your work?
Right. Well, you want me to talk about a case, or do you want me to?
Sure. That'd be a great example.
The concept came to me as a result of several cases in which the uncertainty was such a key part of what the patient had to deal with. So one of the cases that I wrote about in my journal report in the Journal of Psychodynamic Psychiatry was about a young a woman in her 70s, early 70s, who had an MRI and accidentally found there were infiltrates found in her lungs, which is not uncommon. So the question was what to do, and the oncologist decided they should remove these infiltrates, and they found that it was very early small cell type lung cancer. And the idea was to do a follow-up in 6 months. In 6 months, there were many more infiltrates, and the patient was told by the oncologist that if you're alive in 6 months, we will know it wasn't malignant, and that's where we are. So this patient became, of course, morbidly depressed and panicked, and that's when I first saw her. So she was in the throes of panic and depression, both feeling that her life was about to be over, and my only response could be, can we live with the uncertainty that maybe this is not going to be the way that you are expecting it to be, which is that you're going to die, because she was preparing to die.
That was the core truth of the moment that you put into words for her. Can you live with the uncertainty?
So I then asked her why she had chosen to think about herself as somebody who was going to die rather than perhaps somebody who's going to live. And this is a not uncommon problem with cancer patients, where the prognosis could be, that you're going to have a 70% chance of living in 5 years, and the patient chooses to focus on the 30% that they're going to die. So you want to investigate what might be the reason they choose one versus the other. So with this particular patient, her past history revealed that her sister had chronic kidney disease, and she died at 11. And my patient felt that she was neglected throughout her childhood because her sister got more attention because she was a chronically sick person. So she, in fact, had an unconscious wish to be sick. So with this coming to the surface, there was a little bit of a respite from the idea that she is absolutely going to die. And plus the fact we had some antidepressants on board and some tranquilizers. The question then came up was, what is she going to do if she only has 6 months to live? And she began to focus on trying to make sure that she had some kind of a connection with her grandchildren, which had been ruptured by the fact that she and her daughter were not getting along. And I did some investigation into that aspect of her life. And it turns out that her daughter was brought up and treated like she treated her sister. So they had a very difficult relationship. It was a divorce. The daughter took the father's side and stopped talking to the mother. There were 3 grandchildren, which my patient never really got much involved with. So her project for her last 6 months was to write a memoir to her grandchildren about her past. So the 6 month arrived, the patient was alive, the MRI was fine, and what we had achieved at the end of the 6 months was a reunion and a reconnection between her daughter and herself and involvement with the grandchildren, and it was a very happy ending.
Now, let me ask you a question, and I'm going to be provocative here.
Sure.
Do you think it's reasonable to consider, it's obviously not provable, but reasonable to conjecture that her connection to you, which was the vehicle for her connecting with her family members in a new, affectionate way, might have had an impact on her medical prognosis and outcome?
Oh, I have no doubt. I think one of the things that does happen...
Well, I thought I was being provocative. For you, it's commonplace, no?
Well, one of the things that happens, and one of the reasons I like doing this kind of work, is that the time pressure of recognizing that people have a short lifespan makes therapy move very, very quickly. So you can get a tremendous amount of psychological growth very, very quickly. And as a classically trained analyst, this was always a problem for me because I'm a person who likes action.
Sure.
So you get a lot of action with people who have a short lifespan.
But just to stay with this point, I've read what you've written, and one thing comes across with all the cases you present is that you allow, if not encourage, a deep positive attachment to you.
Oh, without a doubt, I think
you are available. They have your cell number. You are reassuring. You are really a caretaker of them, and that has to be key for the work you're doing.
Well, I certainly would recommend that be the case, not only during the treatment of cancer patients, but even right now, because I did have that same feeling during 9/11. That, you know, it was a crisis then, and it is a crisis now that requires us to be real people and real doctors and real caretakers. Our patients are terrified, vulnerable, and quite regressed. And so the ability to be a calming, almost parental, transferential object is very helpful. So that's not a classical position, but it is.
Well, I mean, I don't want to set classical up as a straw man. I think a physicianly analytic approach is to be where the patient needs you to be. And at times, it's classically interpretive is just the spot on way to be with someone. And at times, being deeply caretaking is the spot on way to be with someone. And it obviously changes over the trajectory of a treatment. And we need the flexibility to change with the requirements of the patient and the situation, for sure. The challenge, of course, today is how does one be reassuring today? Except maybe, as you say, to focus on our joint enterprise of learning to tolerate uncertainty.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly true. One of the problems with this situation, as opposed to a cancer situation, is that the defenses against death anxiety, which are available to patients who are not in the situation like we're in now, don't exist. So let me just talk for a few minutes here about what the usual defenses of death anxiety are.
Yes, please.
Okay. So it's been shown experimentally that unconscious death anxiety exists, and there are unconscious mechanisms of defense against death anxiety. And they include a lot of things that we are being deprived of right now, such as being able to work, being able to be useful members of society, being able to be partake in culture, being able to visit and take care of family, make a living, make money, save money. So a lot of these kinds of things that ordinarily still exist for cancer patients are being stripped away because people are out of work.
Sure.
You know, the cultural activities are shut down. We're all losing money. So this has heightened our death anxiety.
So tell me what death anxiety is, because fear of losing a living and losing contact with friends and loved ones and cultural activities, everybody could understand. But you add the phrase death anxiety to that. Help me understand that.
So I understand death anxiety as sort of having four aspects. One is the anxiety about dying. How will I die? Will I die in pain? Will I die suffocating? Will I be able to tolerate the experience? Will I go crazy? So that's one of the aspects. How will I die? Another aspect of death anxiety is, what will it be like to be dead? Could I tolerate being dead? And finally, the other is the ability to accept the sense that you no longer exist. So those would be some of the existential issues that involve death anxiety, which, like as you said, also complement the others that we know about, which is losing our loved ones, you know, feeling empty and alone. Guilt, castration, all of those things. But these other three, I think, also play some role.
And we are all together suffering, hopefully, minor versions of that now with the added uncertainty. Norm, this has really been your life's work and your life's contribution. Tell us a bit about yourself. How did you get into this? This is such an unusual, if not trying, field that you spend so much time and energy and thought and research in. Tell us about that.
So, Yeah, there are several things that contributed to my choosing this. Of course, as most people, I chose this unconsciously. I had no idea, you know, why I was doing this until I began to write the book and thought a lot about why I was there. Although I did have some sense about it, as I mentioned to you before our talk, at the time that my mother died, when I eulogized her, thanking her for giving me certain experiences that allowed me to be aware of the problem of death. As I mentioned to you, I grew up with a sick mother who had mitral stenosis and minor degrees of heart failure when I was a little boy. And as I got older, she had more episodes, and she would have severe atrial fibrillation and have to be taken to the hospital. But in addition to that, she also had a lot of hysterical traits. And my experience was that there were many death scenes, not unlike the end of an opera, where she would sort of ask me to kiss her as she was going into the ambulance because it was probably the last time I would see her. So after four or five of these episodes, I became, you know, quite used to dealing with her impending death. That's one factor. Then there were a couple of others, one of which was my early experience on the floor in my internship. I think it was about the second month. I was the only one on the floor in the evening, and there was a young girl of 16, 17 who was admitted to my floor with tiny petechiae in her ankles. And her parents brought her upstairs because her blood counts were off, but they didn't tell her the diagnosis. She came up to my floor, and within 1 hour, she was having grand mal seizures because she was having hemorrhages into her brain because she was in acute leukemic crisis. And there I was, an intern in a second month of his experience, pumping Valium into her veins and trying to get her to stop seizing. And she would stop and she would start. And then she eventually, of course, expired. And it was my job to tell these parents that their daughter of 17 had passed on, which was no easy task. I received no support from the staff in the morning after this happened. And it left a very powerful feeling in me that this should not be, you know, the experience of any medical student, intern, resident, that there should be some courses or some way in which doctors were educated as to how to deal with death and dying, how to talk to parents about it, how to talk to patients about it. There were one or two other experiences. There were two other experiences very briefly. When I was a medical student, I had a very severe case of infectious mononucleosis. And for 2 weeks, I was told that the cells looked as if I had leukemia. So they weren't sure for 2 weeks whether I had leukemia or mono. So fortunately, it turned out to be mono. Finally, just remembered that and when we had the London flu, I was in my training analysis, and I ended up being hospitalized for something that is not unlike what they're talking about with this flu, where I was in respiratory failure. I was on oxygen and bronchodilators for 10 days and came, you know, survived, of course. But so this experience resonates with my experience with London flu. So those experiences, I found myself at Memorial suddenly, for reasons other than conscious ones, helping people with cancer.
You know, so often in the lives of physicians and certainly therapists of various sorts, we can trace our interest in these areas to childhood experiences. But I must say, Norm, that there aren't many of us who, when faced with the challenging childhood scenarios that you've described, were able to turn it around and make such contributions to the field, to the well-being of so many patients, and to the training of so many other clinicians over the years.
That's very kind of you, Harvey. Thank you. It's been a great challenge for me, and obviously it's all about mastering my own death anxiety, which I think I'm close to.
It's something we all have to work on in our own way, and hopefully we have lots and lots of time to do it. Norm, thank you for sharing this with us. I'm grateful we worked together on the IPA and Health Committee, which is an opportunity for me to learn from your skills. And I appreciate your taking the time to share this with our larger audience. I appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.